Centuries ago, while the world was going to hell in a handcart and various hordes were spilling each other's blood across the wide earth, the finest minds in the Christian church gathered together in Constantinople. Here were two of the items on their agenda. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? And if a fly falls into consecrated water, will the fly be consecrated or the water desecrated? There are times when the Christian church seems like the preserve of the most spectacular irrelevance. You probably all remember the tsunami in 2004, Southeast Asian tsunami. Happened on a Saturday night, and vast tracts of that part of the world were destroyed. And come the Sunday morning, senior churchmen in this country were talking about how this made them feel about God, and whether they were angry with God, and was it acceptable to be angry with God. And meanwhile, in Sumatra, a group of people went into their church where the walls by now were only 18 inches high. And they got on with worshipping together, despite the empty seats of those who'd been washed away. Some years ago, I was at a missions conference, and in the middle of a kind of plenary session, a woman got up from a church in Nigeria. It was at the time when there was a lot of anti-Christian violence taking place in that country. And she said, "You people," meaning the Westerners who were running the conference, she said, "You people have the theological luxury of having your debates about women in leadership," she said. "Our men have gone. Our husbands and our sons have been taken away and murdered. If there are no women in leadership, there is no church," they said. "Having the discussion is a luxury that you have, and we do not." Sometimes, like I say, the church is the preserve of the spectacularly irrelevant. Immediately before this, Jesus had walked on water and healed people by the hundreds. Immediately after it, he will transform a man's life in an instant from silence to shouts of joy. And in the meantime, the authorities who knew no better and the disciples who should have known better are trying to drag him towards an esoteric debate about what makes us holy or unclean or good or acceptable. And far from articulating the world and making God sense of it all, which is what good theology should be all about, their theological debate was a retreat from the complicated world into a tabloid-style simplification into right and wrong and good and bad and acceptable people and unacceptable people. And Jesus was having none of it. And there are two key lessons from him here. And that would be so much easier if I can keep my Bible open on the right page. There we are. Here's the first lesson, that you and I should start asking the right questions instead of the wrong ones. Now, I think it's fair to say that the Pharisees get an awful lot of bad press. Please remember that they were living in an occupied land. Please remember that their ancient and historic faith, which had been passed on to them by their forefathers, was a precious charge. It was barely tolerated under Roman rule, and they wanted to ensure that it didn't get further eroded. So actually, when they come up and they ask this question in verse 5 about washing of hands, it's not entirely unreasonable. They're saying, "Look, you know, we don't want our faith to get eroded. Could you please tell us why you let these people get away with this?" But as is often the case, Jesus, with that piercing understanding of his, wanted to know the question behind the motivation, the question. Wanted to know the motivation behind them asking it in the first place. Was this really a concern for holiness, which he would have applauded? Or was it a lust for power? Was what they were doing making a dent in the reputation of God, and that's why they were so fussed about it? Or did they see this as an opportunity to make a dent in the reputation of the disciples instead? And this rather strange thing comes up in verses 11 to 13 about the Korban. Korban was a Jewish rule where you could take some things that would naturally have been given to others, and you know, that's for God and no one else could touch it. But people were using this as an excuse to shirk their family responsibilities. If we turn our stated desire to honour God into a means of dishonouring those whom he loves, then how can we ever call it serving him? And he calls them to account for that. He says, look, isn't this what you are doing? Isn't this how you are behaving? He says, please, for God's sake, ask the right questions of yourselves and of each other rather than the wrong ones. Look, this is not a call for constant introspection. But it is a call once in a while to stop and ask, why am I so bothered about this tradition or this habit? Did I get it from God? Or did I inherit it from the church? Which of those is it? And which one should matter more? Verse 14, Jesus, having had this conversation with the Pharisees, deliberately chooses to take it wider. He calls the crowd to him and says, listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. He goes on to say, verse 15, that holiness is determined not by what goes from the outside in, but what comes from the inside out. The secrets of the heart, the tick, tick, tick that makes us work. There, he said, the holiness is revealed. So in a sense, he has this private conversation with the Pharisees. Then he calls the big crowd together and says, I want you to think about this as well. Then he takes the disciples off in private. He says, now have you actually got this? Because I really want to make sure he raises the whole thing again in private with them, just to make sure that they will actually think about it. Listen, the pursuit of holiness starts with a heart inclined towards Jesus, and it works outwards from there. It is not constructed of, or it does not consist of, the things that we do on the outside for the benefit of our Christian brothers and sisters, or the benefit of those who observe us from outside the church. Given what I've told you about the year that I was going to say have lived through, that's a silly thing to say, the year I'm still living through, it won't surprise you to know that I'm feeling quite spiritually fragile. It won't surprise you to know that I find myself more vulnerable than I would choose to be. And one of the things that I've done to address that is that I've been revisiting the diet that I had as a teenage Christian. And for me, that was reading the works of A.W. Tozer. Great American pastor in the 1930s to 1960s, finished his ministry actually in Canada. Books like The Pursuit of the Holy, books like Leaning into God. And those have been tremendously helpful to me, but they're also tremendously provocative. Listen to this. The deep disease, he says, of the human heart is a will broken loose from its centre, like a planet which has left its central sun and started to revolve around some strange body from outer space which may have moved in close enough to draw it away. If our desire for a heart given to God has been replaced with an anxiety about the appearance of a Christian flavoured life, then it's high time we got that planet back into the right orbit again. Because it is spinning out of control, and it's not doing us any favours, and it's not doing God any favours. So in this rather awkward story that we have read, Jesus calls the people to account and he says, ask the right questions. Make sure the planet isn't in a wobble. Make sure you're right in the right orbit by asking the right questions. And the test of how holy we are, the test of how much our heart is given to God, the test of whether we're actually orbiting around his Son, may well come when we face the needs of those who present themselves where we were least expecting it. You know, a little bit later on in the story, after we've had this discussion with the Pharisees and the crowd and the disciples, then in the second half of the story, we read that Jesus went to Tyre, entered a house, didn't want anyone to know it, and then, of course, this woman comes barreling in. You know, here he is, a private gathering in an unadvertised part of the programme, and this person shows up. And, you know, this woman is all kinds of wrong. You know, she's the wrong ethnicity. She's a Gentile. She's born in the wrong place, on the wrong side of the tracks in Syrophoenicia. Her daughter hasn't even got a normal disease. Ironically, it says, after the discussion they've just had about clean and unclean, she has an unclean spirit. Everything is against her. She's the wrong person in a wrong place at a wrong time, asking for the wrong thing. In verse 26, where she presents her need, you can almost hear the collective intake of breath as everyone in that private house, which was suddenly not so private anymore, waits to see what it is that Jesus will say. And of course, he pretty much says, to start with, not now. Not now. Because what we've got going on in Mark, and in fact in all the Gospels, is the sense that Jesus was sticking to a heavenly timetable with regards to his revelation as to who he really was. And quite frankly, revealing it right now to a rank outsider was not on the list. This was not meant to happen right now. It was meant to happen further down the road. The disciples would take the gospel out to people like this woman, and then she shows up without the least consideration for the timetable. And she muscles in on this private gathering and presents him with this mucky problem to sort out. So what is it that makes him change his mind then? I think it's her honesty about who she is. And it's her desperation to save the one that she loves. And Jesus using, for those of you who love a bit of theological grammar, the prophetic perfect, talks about something that's yet to happen as if it's already happened. Because he's so sure. And he says, actually, your daughter's fine. Go home and find her. And Mark says she does that and finds it to be exactly the case. This is a mess. This is messy. She's the wrong kind of person picking the wrong moment to say the wrong kind of thing. This is not in the plan. I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that we rarely find God in the plan. Very often we find him somewhere else. It's been my privilege to be in ministry for over 30 years now. I'm not actually 95, but sometimes it feels like, you know, to serve in a pastorate in four very, very different churches, in very, very different kinds of places. And I am more convinced now than ever I have been before that faith is tested in the grey far more than it is in the black and white. I am convinced that faith is tested far more when we have to choose between this good and that one, or between this bad and that one, than ever it is when we choose between good and evil. God is to be found more in the mess than he is in the tidiness. God is honoured more in the honest and unexpected and occasionally flawed decisions that we make than ever he was in the grand plan. A friend of mine used to say pastors only ever move on from churches so they can tell stories about the previous one. Well, I'll do this one anonymously. But I had some very noisy people in my previous church who talked often about being radical and edgy and authentic. And I had some very quiet people who talked little and loved much. And I think they maybe are the ones I should have listened to. It took me far longer than it should have done to realise that they were the ones reflecting the authentic life of Jesus Christ. They were the ones who were the real radicals, not the one who called themselves radicals. It's the ones who had learnt to love as he had loved. The ones who had learnt to pick up the mess. The ones who'd learnt to embrace the unexpected. And to do the Jesus thing in the middle of it. For 9 years, I served on the Council of Global Connections. Now, Global Connections is a kind of consortium that brings together the heads of mission agencies and the heads of Bible colleges where missionaries are trained, and for some bizarre reason, me. It was really weird, you know, all these august people and me. Rather, it was the sort of, you know, comic counterbalance or something. I don't know. It was a very strange place to be. And I served my time, and I was re-elected three times, did my 9 years. When I got to the end of the 9 years, after which you couldn't serve any longer, they invited me to address this august company of terribly important people. And I talked to them quite a bit about language, because when you put missions experts in a room, it's not long before they start talking as if they're in Sandhurst, and they start talking about territory and gains and combat and all of that. And then this is what I said. I'm going to read it out to you. I have been, so you can tell it was a few years ago, I've been in ministry for 27 years. And for the past dozen or so, combined it with other communications interests in broadcast, written and digital media. Through it all, tone is king. Lots of people in lots of churches and lots of organisations like to call themselves radical. It's a hipster label we wear on our souls, much as some people might wear one on their jeans. The real radicals are the champions of love. They are the ones who neither court nor relish the fanfare. They are the ones who neither seek praise nor pout at criticism. Like a tuning fork struck on the harsh reality of life, they vibrate with the tone of Jesus. So ask the right questions and do the right things. Been a number of unusual things have happened this year. As I say, I've ended up writing for Sue Ryder, which is an interesting place to be. Ended up working with Dogs Trust, and there may be more coming with that. Ended up writing this little book for the Dogs Trust about this dog I've adopted. Ginny the Rescue Dog. It's a bit of a clue, really, as to what it's about. Little children's book, and that's being sold in aid of the Dogs Trust. And here's another interesting development of that. I'm going into a school, not this week, the following week, to conduct a lesson based all around the book. And one of the things that we will do is what's called hot seating. The teacher had to explain that to me, where actually what it means, they're a year six group, is where, you know, you will put yourself in the place of me or the dog, or, you know, and you'll think about what that means. Please, please, please go home and hot seat this passage in Mark's Gospel. Please go home and read it quietly when I'm not here going on at you. And place yourself in it. How does it feel to be affronted and stuffy and put in your place when Jesus says that your focus is all wrong? How does it feel to be so desperate that, like the woman, you don't care who you offend or how you do it? How does it feel to be the owner of that house when your dream has come true and the Messiah of God, for goodness sake, comes for dinner and this blinking woman comes in and interrupts it all? How does that feel, I wonder? Some of you may have noticed I've got a rather weird Bible on here, and I'll close with this. It's also not a very good Bible to balance on there, that's another problem. It's called the Darlington Testament. I don't know if any of you have come across it. It was produced in the year 2011 as part of the whole Bible Fresh Initiative to mark 400 years since the King James Version. What I love about this book is that it's handwritten. So you've got crossings out, and you've got children who've decided to embellish the gospel, and you've got mistakes, and you've got bits where there's, you know, different handwriting on the same page. I absolutely love it. And the reason I love it is because this is how the gospel is being written now. In your handwriting, and your handwriting, and your handwriting, with mistakes and splots on the page. And somehow God still comes through. And if he's going to go on doing that, then please God, we need to ask the right questions instead of the wrong ones. And we need to do the right thing when the unexpected happens. That way, the gospel will go on being written. Messy and wonderful and attractive. And I think that's what God wants. Thank you.